Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
This podcast is supported by Cartier. In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, Cartier shares testaments of love in all its forms from around the world. Please keep listening for today's love story later in this episode.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. When people ask for advice, do they really want to hear what you have to say? Sometimes it's hardest to find a friend who can just lend a sympathetic ear. This week, actor Laura Dern takes us deep into a friendship that experienced a unique evolution. Here she is reading Rhonda Mahood Lee's essay, I Will Be Your Mother Figure.
It's all hit the fan, Mother, Ned said to me over the phone. He was old enough to be my father. He called me Mother because I was his priest. Or I had been before I moved to North Carolina from Louisville, where Ned and I met. My first job after ordination was as the assistant priest at the Episcopal Church, where he had been a member for decades. After I moved away, we stayed in touch. So when he called on that spring day, I knew exactly what had hit the fan. At 71, Ned was in love with a 28-year-old man. And the church was going nuts. The parish was a fairly gay-friendly community in a city of Midwestern reserve and Southern denial. A few gay men had joined the church in the 1970s when it was a safe place for those who lived 5 days a week in the closet and wanted to be quietly themselves on Sundays. For 35 years, Ned fit right in. That's how long he'd been celibate after the demise of his relationship with the man he called the love of his life. Since then, he had poured his passion into the church. For Ned, being a Christian meant loving your neighbor through the good, the bad, the scandalous, and the ordinary. He knew who drank too much, whose adult child was headed for her third divorce, and which pillars of the church treasured memories of affairs long since set aside. And he never breathed a word. Now Ned was in the throes of a wild passion. And it never occurred to him to hide his joy. When he came out of the closet in his 30s, the Episcopal Church welcomed him. Since then, the church had deepened its affirmations of gays and lesbians. So he was disappointed his friends couldn't be happy for him, while they insisted they were simply concerned. After all, what did he really know about this young man? At Ned's age, wasn't he emotionally, financially, even physically vulnerable? When the parish's two priests called him in for counseling, Ned cut it short, saying, "This is sexist. If I were seeing a 20-something woman, you'd be slapping me on the back." I was concerned, too. Before ordination, I'd worked on sexual health hotlines and at Planned Parenthood, and had counseled survivors of domestic violence, where I heard more than my share of love gone wrong. But I knew enough of Ned's story to know that to him, this new love felt like a gift. And I wasn't his counselor. I was his friend and a priest. Priests sometimes have to ask hard questions, gently, about our parishioners' lives. But mostly we're called simply to offer them the kind of compassionate presence that we believe defines the holy. So from 500 miles away, I listened. What I heard was a new zest for life in an old man, for whom open, joyful love had long been elusive. In his 20s, Ned had married a female friend who knew he was gay. As he told me, it was the early 60s we thought gays could change if you prayed hard enough. He and his wife realized on their wedding night that wasn't true. But they stayed together for a decade and two children. When they separated, they shared custody and stayed friends. Ned and his ex had been young together, cherished dreams, and raised children. When she died, years after their divorce, Ned mourned with deep despair and began drinking to excess. When he ended up in the hospital, close to liver and kidney failure, the critical care doctor asked, "Were you trying to kill yourself? Because you damn near did." "Yeah, I guess I was," Ned said. He never drank again. By that time, Ned's relationship with the love of his life had ended, and he had resigned himself to living without a romantic partner. When I joined his parish, he was thrilled because he was used to female companions leading him to God. Raised Catholic, he loved the Virgin Mary with a deep yet canny adoration, as both a mother figure and a friend who could put in a good word for him to her son. Ned served as the only male member of the parish's altar guild, who cleaned and decorated the church for worship. My first Easter as a priest, I stood in awe of the mountains of lilies, roses, ferns, and gold-embroidered white tapestry adorning the altar. Seeing my wide eyes, Ned said, "That's Easter, Mother." "Yeah," I replied, "as staged by Franco Zeffirelli." He laughed, and we were friends. I introduced him to the writing of Michel Tremblay, a novelist from my home city of Montreal whose devastating love story, The Heart Laid Bare, made us both weep. Ned taught me about opera, buying me CDs of the classics. And when he discovered I'd never eaten risotto, he hosted a dinner party to teach me to cook it, with lobster flown in from Maine. As Ned's 70th birthday approached, he told me he was ready to go, to meet Mary at last. His heart rhythm was irregular, his teeth and prostate were failing, and osteoporosis had set in. All problems that lowered his quality of life and offended his love of beauty. When I probed for signs of depression, he saw through my pastoral strategy. "Don't worry, Mother, I'm not suicidal. I just wish one of those embarrassing ailments would actually kill me." Now, a couple of years after Ned had confessed his weariness, his body had come thrillingly alive again. Fresh energy animated his voice when we talked about his young man, a woodworker who created elegant furniture as easily as he made home repairs, and who was also devouring the Michel Tremblay novels I had given to Ned, his fierce concentration reminding my friend of himself in younger days. The young man's beauty was undoubtedly part of the attraction, isn't it usually? The church leaders issued dire warnings. Ned could be murdered in his bed, robbed, or left heartbroken, to which he answered, "Don't you think I know that?" To me, he wrote that he expected the affair to be something of a good memory in a few months or so. But he was hurt that the community he'd supported for so long assumed it knew better than he what was good for him. No one suggested Ned invite his young man to church. Not a soul asked when they could meet him. Then, Ned discovered what the young man had tried to conceal. That he was a drug addict and an alcoholic who had known long periods of recovery, but had once again relapsed. When Ned called on Good Friday to tell me, I was in my new church preparing for the evening service. As I stared at the bare altar symbolizing the death of Jesus, I felt my friend's pain echoing into the emptiness. As he wailed, I listened. That was all I could do. In those tortured days, it was enough. Better than the "I told you so's" he was hearing from his own church, and even from himself. "I was pig-headed and infatuated," he told me. "Money I gave him only fed the problem." He ran a background check on the young man, discovering pages of charges, but only one conviction for possession of drug paraphernalia. Angry and embarrassed, Ned refused to take the young man's calls, and he withdrew emotionally from the church. After a couple of months, happier news popped up in my inbox. The young man was back. With the truth out, their relationship was on a firmer foundation. He was in recovery again, seeing a therapist and working long hours at the carpentry he loved. And Ned was still quite smashingly in love with him. The realism and the wide romantic streak I loved in Ned were both evident as he mused, "It may all fall apart again," or as someone said, "the horse may laugh." The latter thought referred to a last-ditch hope for a miracle. But, of course, Christians are supposed to believe in miracles. In Ned's last message to me, he complained of the cold, miserable winter Louisville had been suffering. But it was early March, so relief was in sight. "When spring arrives," he told me, "I intend to dance naked in Seneca Park." Those words made me smile through my tears 10 days later when I learned Ned had died in his sleep. That night I cooked risotto in his honor. I sipped champagne and hummed along to an opera Ned had introduced me to. I pictured him listening to Pavarotti with the Virgin Mary at his side. And when he asks her, "May I tell you about my young man?" she leans in to listen, as any loving mother would.
Laura Dern, reading Rhonda Mahood Lee's piece, "I Will Be Your Mother Figure." What would Ned have said about this essay? Some thoughts from Rhonda in a minute.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Rhonda Mahood Lee, an Episcopalian priest in North Carolina, says she received a lot of emotional letters from people after this essay was published. Many were from older gay men who said she captured some of their experience, especially the fact that they needed to hide their sexuality at some point in their lives.
And some of them had found love that endured, and others had not, and they felt that the fact that my friend had found love so late in life was just a lovely, hopeful thing for them.
That said, not everyone loved this story, including Ned's immediate family.
I heard from my friend's son, who was very concerned that I did not understand that what actually had happened to his father, in his opinion, was elder abuse. So we had a conversation about that. I tried to impress upon him that I was writing primarily about my relationship with Ned, my friendship, and that I was expressing what I believed was truth, but that all truth, really, this side of the divine mind, is necessarily partial. And so I couldn't know everything that had happened between Ned and the young man, but rather only what Ned had chosen to share with me, and that from where I sat, it did not seem as if he had been abused. That certainly was not what he had shared with me.
Some readers were critical of Rhonda for writing this essay since Ned wasn't able to give consent. We asked her if she thinks Ned would have wanted this story out there.
While he was alive, no, I don't believe he would have wanted me to tell this story while he was alive. He was a fairly private person. But once he was dead, I actually think that he would have liked the story to be told. But something I know deeply about Ned is that he was a real romantic. He loved beauty. And I think he would have understood that I wrote that essay with love, that I wrote it as really a testament to the love he and I shared, and that his love for the young man and with the young man was secondary to that, but was also a story that had its beauty. And so now that he's gone, I think he would have liked that story to be told and for strangers to appreciate the beauty that was in that relationship.
Rhonda's relationship with Ned was complex and evolved over time. They weren't always friends.
Sometimes it's hard for people to understand, since we're so close in the church and we care for one another and we're called to care for one another, why a priest might say to a parishioner, "I'm not your friend." And really, it's a question of keeping those boundaries clear because of the inherent power dynamics in the pastoral relationship. So what I tell parishioners sometimes is, you know, as your priest, I am open to receiving a phone call from you any time of the day or night. If you are in the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning, absolutely feel free to call me. Something you can rely on is that as your priest, I will not call you at 2 o'clock in the morning needing your help. Now, once the pastoral relationship has been dissolved and either the parishioner or the priest has moved on, it is possible sometimes to become friends on a new footing that's more of equals. And so I do have some friends who formerly were my parishioners. And Ned was, I would say, one of my closer friends who had at one time been my parishioner.
Rhonda Mahood Lee. She's an Episcopalian priest in North Carolina. Dan Jones has some thoughts about this essay. We'll hear them after the break.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. To understand changes in migration, I traveled to the Darien Gap. Thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the border of Colombia and Panama in the hopes of making it to the United States. We interviewed hundreds of people to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Welcome back. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times.
I'm always curious about how we judge other people's relationships, how easy it is under the guise of concern or care or even love to dismiss someone else's relationship. And there's also something that's sort of insidious about someone's happiness that can feel like a threat, even just to some people. I love these lines when she says, "No one suggested Ned invite his young man to church. Not a soul asked when they could meet him," and how like corrosive that kind of attitude is. You know, all born of suspicion, and that his happiness can't possibly be real or lasting, or their love can't possibly be real or lasting. And to tell you the truth, it's not that these concerns aren't rational. It's just that sometimes love isn't rational, you know, and why people fall for each other isn't rational, and it takes a while to overcome that hurdle of judgment and just finally realize, well, you know, maybe happiness is just happiness.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for the New York Times. Many thanks to Laura Dern, who chose this week's essay because she says to her, it feels like an authentic expression of love.
There's something very broken about and beautiful about the idea of one person's experience being judged because of another person's choices in a love affair. And the fact that regardless of friends or family or church, this man at the end of his life had a pure experience of love. And he can't control the agenda of the other person's choices. But, you know, on a spiritual level, how magnificent to know love and to be reminded of love. And that just really moved me.
Thanks again to Laura Dern. She can currently be seen in Fox Searchlight's Wilson. She also stars in the hit HBO series Big Little Lies. And later this year, Laura can be seen in the highly anticipated revival of Twin Peaks and in Disney's Star Wars: The Last Jedi. Next week on the podcast, Mireille Enos of the ABC series The Catch reads a story out of Africa.
A Somali proverb says that a woman should be either married or in her grave. And in the Horn of Africa, the proverb might as well go on to say that if she is married, she had better be pregnant, nursing, or postmenopausal.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.